Tonight on Dateline.
You got four lives, four beautiful young lives. My daughter literally fought for the very last moment.
Hi. Welcome back.
Kaylee and Maddie were doing everything right that night. They had no idea what was about to happen.
It's America's most heartbreaking mystery.
Four students in the middle of the night stabbed to death.
My heart sank. How did this happen?
Now, exclusive new information.
I texted Xana, I love you.
A friend speaks out for the very first time.
The first 48 hours were like a movie.
Revealing new details about the investigation.
Amazed. The incredible stuff they did with the car and the electronics.
The DNA on the knife sheath. That is extremely strong evidence.
The manhunt.
I went, what? The Idaho murder suspect in Pennsylvania.
You cannot let this guy out of eyesight.
They actually just barged in.
The suspect.
I feel like I witnessed a side of Brian that other people might not have.
This is someone who wants to show us that he has power.
What was it like to sit in that room, watch him?
He looks scared, as he should be.
We're ready. We're ready for this case.
Tonight, we take you inside the case the whole country is watching. I'm Lester Holt, and this is Dateline. Here's Keith Morrison with Killings in a College Town.
It was Sunday, and all around was a damp gray gloom. And the hush that had finally settled on student housing at 3 a.m. or 4 lingered all morning long. The morning after the night before. After the big hometown football game and the noisy parties that followed.
We'd gone to a fraternity until probably pretty late that night.
In Moscow, home of the University of Idaho, and the fraternities and sororities that were a second family to a sophomore named Martha.
I got up probably around 10:45, 11, got ready to go do some homework.
So, that November 13th, Martha drove the few blocks over to the Sigma Chi fraternity, where she and some friends planned to work together.
What was this project you were talking about working on?
It was just a group project for one of our classes. We were supposed to meet at 12:30, and we were waiting on one other person, and it was Hunter Chapin.
Hunter was late. He was one of the Chapin triplets, the instantly recognizable siblings who all attended U of I. Everyone seemed to know Hunter and Maisie and Ethan.
All three of them were in Greek life, and so we got to know all of them pretty well. It was a family affair.
But Martha waited. No sign of Hunter. Getting closer to 1 o'clock now. And across town, senior Katerina Hockema was waking up to some news.
I saw a regular text message notification from the Moscow Police Department.
It took a minute to register. The text was something named for the college mascot, a vandal alert.
Vandal alert, Moscow PD investigating a homicide on King Road near campus. Stay away from the area and shelter in place.
Back at Sigma Chi, Martha's group decided to be proactive with their friend Hunter Chapin.
We called him and we said, hey, you know, are you coming? And he said, no, I think Ethan's dead.
Hunter says, I think Ethan's dead.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like to hear that?
It was so beyond. I honestly didn't even believe it.
Martha's thoughts immediately turned to Ethan's girlfriend, Xana Kernodle.
I texted Xana and I said, I love you. And I didn't want to call her because I imagined that whatever was happening was probably fairly overwhelming. And then we walked out into the courtyard and somebody said that Xana was dead. And again, it didn't really even check out with me.
What was going on? The house Xana shared with her roommates on King Road was clearly visible from Sigma Chi.
What was going on over there?
Just a lot of people that were really in shock. And so we didn't know if it was a carbon monoxide thing. We didn't know. And so we all basically stood in a big quiet circle and watched all the beginning stuff happen.
The beginning stuff was this. Just before noon, authorities responded to a 911 caller who had reported an unconscious person at the home. Strange, given what had actually happened. But then, the mere thought of anything terrible happening on King Road? Well, unthinkable. And that afternoon, 95 miles north of Moscow, in the town of Rathdrum, Idaho, the parents of another university student, Kaylee Gonsalves, Steve and Christy, were watching a football game.
My niece called me, and she was very upset and crying, and she said, something bad has happened to Kaylee. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, I have a friend down there, and they called me and told me that Kaylee Gonsalves had been killed. And I immediately started trying to call Kaylee, and her phone was going straight to voicemail. So then I started calling Maddie.
Maddie Mogan, Kaylee's longtime best friend.
Her phone would ring and ring and ring and ring and ring. And then I said, okay, everybody needs to like relax, because if something happened to Kaylee last night, Maddie would have called me.
Kaylee had recently moved out of the house at 1122 King Road, but had returned to spend the night with Maddie. Before long, there was a knock at the Gonsalves' door.
And my son said, the sheriff's here. And I actually took off to my bedroom, and the rest of the family answered the door.
It was true. She was dead. They were both dead.
My knees were shaking. I mean, my whole body was shaking.
That's when you lose all hope, you know. You have a little bit of hope, and then it smacks you that there is no hope.
Yeah. Wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy.
No.
And then the news went everywhere. Four students had been murdered in this home just blocks from campus. 21-year-old Madison Mogan, a senior from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Kaylee Gonsalves, also 21. Ethan Chapin, a 20-year-old freshman from Conway, Washington. And Ethan's girlfriend, 20-year-old junior Zana Kernodle of Avondale, Arizona. Incredibly, two roommates survived, Bethany Funk and Dylan Mortensen. For reasons that were unclear, they were not hurt. Police also announced there was no ongoing community risk. Reporter John Webb works at our NBC affiliate, KHQ.
I think it was uneasy for the public to know that four people were killed in their town, and then to hear that there's no threat to the public, but not be described why there's no threat to the public.
That night, students received multiple updates from the university, but none of them eased any minds or made anyone feel safer. And classes were canceled for the following day. Martha returned to her sorority house, and along with dozens of young women, gathered all their beds in one big room.
And just cried, cried, cried. And at this point, we didn't have any answers. Like, we didn't know anything.
Except that their innocent college town, sweet little Moscow, Idaho, wasn't the same anymore. It was going to be famous, world famous, in the worst imaginable way. Four friends dead, including one who wasn't even supposed to be there. Morning came. Monday morning, the day after. And along with it, confusion, anxiety, anger, and unmeasurable grief.
You just feel sick.
Yeah, I went into complete shock. Absolute complete shock. I couldn't cry. I couldn't think.
The Gonsalves family's daughter, Kaylee, along with her best friend, Maddie Mogan, roommate Zana Kernodle, and Zana's boyfriend, Ethan Chapin, had all been found dead in this house on King Road, just a couple of blocks from campus. Killed just hours, really, after this. All four, decked out in game day gear before that Vandal football game.
What's it like seeing all this happen in your hometown and that place you love so much?
It breaks my heart.
Haley Gensner is a reporter for KHQ, our local NBC affiliate. She grew up in Moscow, attended the university, and once lived just off King, a beloved strip of homes where sorority and fraternity members often moved to spend their final semesters at school.
I lived the exact life that they were living. And so it really hit close to home, like, how could this happen?
No one, it seemed, had a clue about that, or what to think or feel after the city's first homicide in 7 years. Moscow police were clearly working the crime scene, but publicly were saying not a word about what they'd found inside, about what had happened, or who might have done it. So local NBC reporter John Webb went to City Hall to see Moscow's mayor and ask him.
He told us that it was a crime of passion. And so we asked, how did you determine that?
This was the mayor's answer.
Because there was no burglary, there was no robbery, there was no hostage taking.
And so he believed it was a crime of passion.
That, along with an earlier police comment that there was no ongoing threat to the community, led veteran Idaho major case investigators like Brad Maskell to some conclusions. Maskell was not working the case, but keeping a close eye on it.
My initial thoughts were, okay, then it's very likely a murder-suicide type of incident. Possibly they're comfortable saying something like that because the suspect is right there in the room with the rest of the victims.
But no, it wasn't that. In fact, the gruesome truth was already being whispered around town. The four had been stabbed to death. Kaylee and Maddie, together in one bed on the home's third floor. Ethan and Zanna on the second floor, in Zanna's bedroom where they were staying. A scene so troubling, some first responders were kept out altogether.
My friend has a friend, knew an EMT, and they weren't even allowed to go in.
Because it was such a violent scene.
Yeah, somebody had done something really bad.
This was a very violent crime. How do you deal with that?
Not easily. I cannot escape it. And he, no, stop. Don't go there. Why are you going there?
We've been married for 27 years, so we have to help the other partner figure out a way to not crush themselves.
Probably the hardest thing a married couple can do.
Yeah, it breaks a lot apart.
And communities, too. In fact, once word got around, and with classes canceled, life in this lively town was stilled. And those who lived along King Road either holed up at home or just left.
I've never been on that road and it'd be so eerily quiet.
Some people sobbed and just like uncontrollably cried. Some people didn't say anything. Some people wouldn't talk really. Some people didn't eat.
The dead had been like family. The only male victim, Ethan Chapin, grew up north of Seattle. First born of the Chapin triplets, Ethan grew tall and especially loved basketball.
Ethan was just incredible, and he was, you know, the gentle giant that was just sweet and always the person when he walked into a room, he'd always kind of perk up and be like, oh my gosh, like, you're here.
Ethan and his siblings all spent summers in high school working at a resort in North Idaho, so it made sense Ethan's major was recreation, sport, tourism.
Got this off the website.
Ethan's girlfriend, Zanna Kernodle, lived in Idaho, then Arizona. She was a promising young gymnast, played several sports in high school. She had majored in marketing.
Zanna was just one of the coolest people on Greek Row, and everybody knew Zanna. Like, it didn't matter who you were, you knew who Zanna was, because she was just so awesome and a friend to everyone.
Zanna also worked part-time at the Mad Greek restaurant in downtown Moscow, as did her roommate, Maddie Mogan.
Maddie was our family as well.
Kaylee Gonsalves' parents can't talk about their own daughter without talking about Maddie.
These girls were best friends since sixth grade, like inseparable. They were lived in a house together. They were true ultimate best friends, and Maddie had been a huge part of our life.
Like Maddie, Kaylee was a high achiever. due to graduate from college early, and had a job lined up with an IT firm in Austin, Texas. So she'd just moved out of the house on King Road, bought a new car, a Range Rover, and had gone back to Moscow for one last weekend.
And she said, well, I want to go show Maddie my car, and there's a Pi-Fi party tonight, and I want to go to the Pi-Fi party. That was the last time that I saw Kaylee.
2 days after the murders, and a full week before Thanksgiving break, an exodus of students had begun.
A lot of students left completely. I think fear was the driving decision behind that.
Oh, and the fear? It was just getting started. Because when police did tell the public what was known about this crime, let's just say it didn't calm anything. Quite suddenly, fame of the very worst kind had come to Moscow, Idaho. Seemed like the whole world was watching.
Another deadly school tragedy, this one involving four students at the University of Idaho.
It could be any student house in the remote town of Moscow, Idaho.
Authorities in Idaho hunt for a mass murderer.
Much to the dismay of those who wanted Moscow not to be known for this.
We want our hidden gem to stay hidden. So to see that we are making international headlines for something like this, it really is like a gut punch.
Okay, so I keep going back about if there's one suspect or if there's multiple suspects.
And this is my theory.
It wasn't long, of course, until the internet crime sleuths latched on.
No dried blood, no blood at all.
And here, unchecked and unrestrained, true crime fans second-guessed and named innocents as possible suspects.
We just got another major puzzle piece.
Viralized speculation.
And I know there's no way that the people getting murdered were not screaming.
Everyone's come out on this one.
Lauren Mathias, a former journalist in Idaho, and her husband, forensic psychologist Dr. John Mathias, host a podcast called Hidden True Crime. Dr. Mathias has more than 25 years' experience as a licensed clinical and forensic psychologist evaluating the accused and the convicted for the court system.
I think the lack of information from law enforcement combined with the intense fear that's building around this case creates a lot of misinformation, and it creates a lot of wild speculation.
Kaylee thought she had a stalker.
That speculation, everything from a stalker to a spurned lover to a cartel hit, was a wave that refused to crest.
Everything that the psychic medium was saying, like, all added up.
But then, Tuesday, 48 hours after the bodies were discovered, Moscow police released a statement that said this. Investigators believe that an edged weapon, such as a knife, was used in the murders. A local shop owner reported detectives had stopped by looking for something like this, a K-bar combat knife. And suddenly, all the rumors of a horrifying crime scene seemed to be confirmed.
We spoke to the coroner, and she said she's never seen anything like that, ever. It was gruesome, is the word she used.
And as for that piece of information about the knife being the first investigative detail released by police?
What did you make of that?
You know, I personally was kind of shocked that that information would have been released. I mean, information specific to the type of murder weapon is something that investigators really try to keep close to the vest.
My name is Chief James Fry with the Moscow Police Department.
And then on Wednesday, 3 days after the murders, Moscow police finally appeared before reporters. But from the first words spoken,
we know you have questions, and so do we.
If anyone felt there was no ongoing threat to the community, well, that had changed. Dramatically.
We do not have a suspect at this time, and that individual is still out there.
And you guys have said repeatedly that there's no threat to the public, but we don't know who the suspect is. We don't know where he's at. How is there no threat to the public at this point?
Well, that's kind of an unknown. Like I said, we took the information that we had at the time.
Information, which was now updated to this.
Or what we don't know, the identity and location of the suspect, the location of the knife or any clothing that was worn by the suspect.
In other words, what did police not know? a lot. But the chief did say there had been no forced entry, which was no surprise to former King Road resident John Webb.
We never locked our doors. We never locked our windows. We never thought that there would ever be anything remotely similar to this happening in King Street, let alone Moscow.
The house was on a hill and had an unusual entry point in the back on what was technically the second floor. It's possible the killer had simply walked in through an unlocked slider into the second floor kitchen and from there down a short hallway towards Zanna's bedroom, as you can see in this virtual tour posted online of the house, where the killer may have encountered a surprise. Ethan, tall and athletic, happened to be spending the night with his girlfriend.
I think that Ethan was the biggest threat in the house. And if his desire was to go up to that third floor, you take the threat out. Where he really wanted to go was that third floor. He wanted to go to see Kaylee. Kaylee and or Maddie or both.
The coroner hinted at what happened. Some of the victims had defensive wounds, but there was no sign of sexual assault.
Does the fact that there was no sexual assault say anything to you?
You know, to me, the perpetrator felt to get whatever it was he was doing done and get out of there, and that his motivation is not a sexual motivation.
But the forensic psychologist John Mathias, deeply versed in the behavioral motivations behind violent attacks on women, had a different take once he read a report from the medical examiner. Except,
in this particular case, the murderer needed to get in and out quickly. So if there were fantasies about sexual assault, he probably realized that he wouldn't be able to pull that off with so many people in the house and so many people in such close proximity.
As the FBI set a command center to assist in the investigation, profilers were assigned. But the search for the knife seemed the most pressing task.
If you bring your own very specialized knife to enact this damage on people, does that say something more?
I think there's something very Freudian in the sense that this is someone who wants to show us that he has power. He wants to show us that he's proud of his knife, and he wants to show us that he's capable of inflicting a lot of pain.
The pressure was on. The small-town police department had some big-league help, but fame and public attention are fickle. Cops were being judged in public, sometimes harshly. Did they have any idea how to catch this killer? Maybe they could start, went the chatter on the internet.
Welcome back.
With that last video of two of the victims. For a week, they continued, night after night and all around Idaho, vigils for Ethan, Zanna, Maddie, and Kaylee. A great collective sorrow.
I can't even begin to imagine what these families are going through. You send your baby off to college. You expect them to come home to you with a diploma and all of these amazing memories. And instead, that's it. They're gone.
And while the internet had been churning with a thousand speculations, the cops, Moscow PD, Idaho State Police, the FBI, picked over the house on King Road, examined what they found, and said nothing. Nothing at all.
Would you expect a lot of useful physical evidence at a crime scene like of that type?
I would believe that there would be a lot of blood evidence. Along with that will be touch DNA. That could possibly give you an identity of the perpetrator.
But complications. The house on King Road had been the regular setting of large parties and noise complaints, like this one 3 months before the murders, as shown on this Moscow police body cam.
Is this your place?
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's Kaylee talking to the officers.
Hey, ladies, how's it going?
Here's another party 2 months before the murders. For this particular party, none of the actual residents was even present.
All right, can you hear me, Maddie?
although officers eventually reached Maddie Mogan.
I'm just frustrated. I'm also so sorry once again.
And the next night, there were two more noise complaints.
Hello, miss. What's your name?
Zanna.
On this tape, Zanna came to the door.
We can hear the music, and that's...
I'm so sorry.
The weekend of the murders, there was another party at 1122 King Road, Friday night through early Saturday. Sources have told us that as many as 150 people attended. And though police were not called this time, the mere presence 24 hours before the killings of so many people, all of whom may have left their DNA behind, made the task of parsing out the killers impossible? If the cops knew, they weren't saying. But, standard procedure, they built timelines and learned all they could about how each of the victims ended up in that house on that night. Here they were together, Saturday, before the Vandals football game, 12 hours before they were killed. With them were two more roommates, Bethany and Dylan, who somehow escaped the fate of the others. What did they know? What did they see? No one would say. That Saturday evening, Ethan and Zanna arrived at Sigma Chi for a party around 9 p.m.
Anything memorable happened at that party?
I hung out with Zanna for a lot of that night, and I'm happy in retrospect because I was able to have what I didn't know at the time, but my last seconds with Zanna.
What spirits was she in?
Zanna was always happy. Zanna was like the true epitome of like a good friend.
Kaylee and Maddie that Saturday evening were in downtown Moscow at a place called the Corner Club, arriving sometime after 10 p.m. 3.5 hours later, around 1:30 a.m., they left the bar together, walked a couple of blocks to a place called the Grub Truck, and got some food, as you can see in this video. That's them ordering at the window.
Hi.
Welcome back.
It just kills me, knowing that they were about to walk into what they walked into. They had no idea what was about to happen.
At precisely 1:49 a.m., one of the women called for a young fraternity member who'd been assigned to help upperclassmen and women drive home safely.
We don't really take Ubers in Moscow. It's a lot cheaper and it's a lot safer. You know who they are. You just get in the car with somebody you know and knows all your friends.
The drive home for Kaylee and Maddie was a little more than a mile. They arrived at 1:56 a.m.
Kaylee and Maddie were doing everything right that night. They were together. They had a safe ride home. They weren't out there, you know.
Coming back from a club, doing any risky behavior out on dates, there was nothing.
Zanna and Ethan had arrived at the house already, a few minutes before Kaylee and Maddie. So by 2 a.m., all six residents were safely home, or so they must have believed. Then, shortly before 3 a.m., this.
Hey, Moscow police, come back here.
A couple of blocks away, Moscow PD responded to a call, and here is what the officer found, recorded on his body cam.
Taken out 21.
Alcohol offense, nothing unusual.
Okay, there's a citation here, and you put the rest of your information on here, but that's all your information.
And then, on that body cam, it's very hard to hear, but what sounded like a barely audible distant scream, which, when the video came out, set internet tongues wagging again.
Okay, you guys, this is absolutely huge. At exactly 3:12 a.m., 45 seconds in, you can hear, like, the screams of a female.
But later, the police, mum about most things, said the incident was not related to the murders. Still, they were looking at video, hours and hours of that from home security systems and doorbells and anything that recorded whatever moved around King Road from 3 until 6 a.m.
And then you're going to expand that out into the further areas of the neighborhood because of possible routes of travel that the perpetrator may have taken. So you're going to want to exploit as much of that digital evidence that might be out there as you can.
Like panning for gold, lots of boring rock. And maybe, here and there, a valuable little nugget, such as a young man about to be known far and wide as Food Truck Guy. Nature, as we know, abhors a vacuum. And no one knows it more than the amateur sleuths of social media. Theories multiplied like spores in a worldwide petri dish. Nothing like the method and order ex-detective Brad Maskell had long preferred.
You're going to dispatch investigators to do interviews with people that are closest to the victims and working outward.
Before he retired, Maskell handled some of Idaho's biggest murder cases. His methods were time-tested.
I want to know as much as I can about their contacts, whether or not there was some rub with a family member, with possibly another friend, with a relationship that possibly went bad. It's very important to an investigator to get to know each victim almost on a personal level.
The online amateurs were doing the same thing in a way, except when the internet discovered the ex-boyfriend, investigative restraint was abandoned altogether. Kaylee Gonsalves' longtime boyfriend and engineering student, Jack DeCour, was soon social media suspect number one.
Jack is a very soft-spoken kid. He adored Kaylee, comes from a very nice family. Jack is the kind of kid that, you know, he would come over and the first thing he would do is, take off his shoes. And
Take the garbage out. That kind of won me over. You know.
Kaylee's parents got to know him well over the 5 years he dated their daughter. But just a few weeks before Kaylee was killed, they had broken up.
What happened to that relationship?
I think they just got to the point that they had been together for so long. They were just kind of on a break, really. Like, let's just see where it goes. And if we wind up together, then we wind up together. But it was very amicable.
Jack and Kaylee bought a dog together. They named him Murphy and shared custody of him. On the night of November 13th, Murphy was staying with Kaylee. So now, a bonfire of rumors. Why was Murphy unharmed? Why didn't he bark and warn everyone? Because he knew the killer? So it went online. And then it was discovered Kaylee and Maddie tried calling Jack 10 times that night between 2:26 and 2:52 a.m. He didn't answer. Why? The internet demanded to know.
You know, people saw the number of phone calls to Jack that night. They kept hearing Jack, 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 and Jack became a suspect.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was hard.
1 week after the killings, Chief James Fry was asked about those phone calls.
Everything that we have taken from those calls, we have followed up on, we've cleared, and we believe that there's no connection there.
But even though police cleared Jack, the online scrutiny remained intense.
Jack would come over and show me private messages that he was getting and stuff, and they were just horrible.
Jack wasn't alone, mind you. There was the guy in the hoodie hanging out near the food truck. Remember, Kaylee and Maddie stopped by there just before they were killed.
Oh, hi.
Welcome back.
And just like that, this guy, caught on video, was internet sleuth suspect number two.
It was kind of eerie.
Reporter John Webb spotted him in the video near Kaylee and Maddie.
As the girls go up front, he steps back. He puts his hat around, puts his hood over, and kind of lurks in the between the rest of the crowd as the girls order their food. Then they wait for 10 or so minutes to go pick up their food on the other end of the grub truck. And then as the girls leave to hop into that private party ride, you could see him throw his hands up. And then he starts walking towards them, walks around a bench, and then goes toward the direction where they lived.
We'll call him food truck guy.
Lauren Mathias learned he lived nearby and learned much more.
On his mother's Facebook page, uh-huh, sleuths have discovered photos of him with a very large knife in front of skinned animals. And hunting seems to be a passion of his, especially when using a knife.
I want to address several areas of speculation.
But within days, without any public explanation, police cleared him as well. He did not do it. It wasn't food truck guy, as police captain Roger Lanier emerged to tell reporters.
We do not believe the following individuals are involved in this crime. The two surviving roommates,
a male seen at the grub truck food vendor downtown, specifically wearing a white hoodie.
As with Jack DeCour, even after police cleared the food truck guy, so-called internet sleuths wouldn't let go of their suspicions. Martha read some of those online theories with disbelief.
One of the things that made it the toughest was the TikTok sleuths.
The TikTok sleuths?
The independent TikTok sleuths and the people who made out the people that I love and know into monsters online. There was some really awful things written on the internet.
Get a real life lesson on how cruel the internet can be.
Yeah, and it went through all parts of our campus. Every digital footprint, every Venmo transaction, every everything.
Any of your friends in particular get hurt or hit by this stuff?
Yeah. And, you know, it was odd because you'd be with people that you're literally, like, actively grieving with. And then you'd, like, open Facebook or you'd open TikTok. And then it would be why the person sitting next to you is the one that did it.
But, as we say, nature abhors a vacuum. And aside from those few comments, the police just weren't filling the incessant demand for answers. Even from victims' families, as Christy Gonsalves told NBC's Gadi Schwartz.
We don't know. My husband is in contact with them every day, the FBI, Moscow, Idaho State Police, and every day he just says, nothing, babe. And I'm like, nothing? And he's like, nothing. I mean, just nothing.
And Steve Gonsalves said the very thing millions were thinking.
We were worried about things going cold, you know?
Yeah.
We were honestly worried about that.
Except they didn't know, couldn't know, about a mysterious white car that just might be important. Someone certainly thought so. Life went gamely ahead in Moscow, Idaho, early December. The big Light Up the Season event would make its way down Main Street as always. But things weren't the same, of course. Couldn't be. Here in reporter Haley Gensner's hometown.
You go to Safeway and you wonder, is the killer checking out next to me? Are they pumping gas right across from me?
It's a weird situation, that's for sure.
I've never seen anything like it. You keep hoping that you'll get some answers, some clarity, and there just isn't any.
How are people feeling about the messages they are getting from various people in authority?
People are frustrated. They're angry. They're confused. But worst of all, they're really scared.
A killer was still out there, which is why Kaylee's family made the decision to delay her funeral. Her father, Steve.
We don't want to destroy that ceremony with that guy, that monster being there and just feeding off everybody's misery and everybody's tears. We want to give enough time for these officers to do what they have to do.
Except Steve had begun to worry, and he wasn't alone, that his daughter's murder would never be solved.
It's going to be a cold case if we don't do something within the next week or two.
Seemed to Steve like somebody had to say it. Might as well be him.
I feel like there's not anything being released, and maybe I'm a fool, but I don't feel like that's okay. I don't know what you're getting paid for if you're not communicating anything. But I honestly laid it on the line for these guys in a room and said, hey, man, I'm a man of honor. I'm not going to lie. Help me. I literally said, help me from hurting myself. Help me from hurting this case. And they just left me. They just left me with nothing.
Around the country, police became the target of intense criticism, to which retired Detective Brad Maskell responded, be patient.
It just says to me that the case was in the stages that I've experienced so many times in my career. It's in a chaotic stage. And, you know, things are happening initially that don't make a lot of sense. But I believe that at the core of the investigation, they're focused and they're doing what they need to do.
Every single word they say is going to be, you know, deeply scrutinized.
So, said former FBI agent and NBC News consultant Greg Rogers, Detectives trying to solve the case of the murdered students had good reason to share very little of what they were discovering, and to try to ignore the critics.
It's not helpful, but to be brutally honest with you, they don't care. They just want to do their job, and they want to solve this case.
Finally, on December 7th, 3 weeks after the murders, there was a glimmer of what seemed like progress. Moscow police put out a public appeal. They wanted to speak with the owner of a 2011 to 2013 white Hyundai Elantra. PIO Robbie Johnson provided a bit more detail 5 days later.
Well, we know through the information we've gathered that that vehicle was in the immediate area of where the homicides took place in the early morning hours of November 13th. So we know the vehicle was there. We just don't know who was in it, who may have owned that car, who may have information about what happened that night. So that is a real big focus right now as we try to get those answers.
My first thought just started being like, how long have they had this information? Where did they get this information? Was it on a camera?
Kaylee's mother, by no means alone in this, was frustrated that the police wouldn't answer those questions.
They believe that person or persons has pertinent information to the case, so that's got to give me some hope. Whether it's a witness, whether it's someone beyond a witness, I don't know.
But there was something the police didn't say when they appealed to the public for help. Several somethings. Things they knew about that white Elantra and its owner. Something so surprising, so deeply shocking, it would just have to remain a very disturbing secret. For now.
So we have information of a white vehicle that was in the area either during the time frame of the homicide or around the time frame of the homicides, and we're looking for a 2011 to a 2013 Hyundai Elantra.
Rarely has a police appeal for help been met by so enthusiastic a response or so many questions.
They hope that this is a break in the case as this heartbroken community attempts to heal.
What was it about this white 2011 to 2013 Hyundai Elantra?
When they were looking for this Elantra, we thought, is this a suspect that they're looking for or a witness? We didn't know. The way that they had posed it was, we think they have answers.
Answers to what? They didn't say.
If you own one or if you know somebody who was driving one the day before or the day after, to please send that tip in.
Did people respond? Oh, yes, they did. In Moscow, of course, but across the state border, too, where Austin Morrison is a student in the other college town, a 10-mile drive away at Washington State University in Pullman.
I definitely think that once people found out about the white Elantra, they kept it in the front of their minds of trying to source and find any clues that they could for the police.
Tips about Elantra sightings poured in, including one from this gas station a few minutes from the site of the murders. An employee there scrolled through security footage from November 13th and spotted a white car drive by quickly, 3:45 a.m. And then, could this be a break?
More than a month after those four college students were killed in Moscow, Idaho, police are investigating a Hyundai car like this one found abandoned in Eugene, Oregon.
In the morning of December 17th, someone called 911 in Eugene, Oregon, reported seeing someone sleeping inside a white Elantra with a damaged front end. And suddenly, the Eugene story was everywhere.
So this is pretty wild. A white Hyundai Elantra was found abandoned.
This car was found in Eugene, Oregon.
It's smashed and has no license plate on it.
That mystery got an army of web sleuths fired up, watched by true crime podcasters Lauren and John Mathias.
We have true crime sleuths with the paper background checks, and they were pulling up the owner of the vehicle and getting the VIN number, and we were getting close-ups of the VIN number. I mean,
Parking tickets.
We had everything on this Elantra.
But like a lot of other web-based fantasies, in the end, it came to nothing. Police investigated and discovered neither the car nor owner had anything whatever to do with the murders in Moscow.
And it wasn't the one?
And it wasn't the one. I guess they make a lot of white Elantras.
What the web sleuths didn't know was that behind the scenes, police were gathering security camera video, capturing images of a white Hyundai Elantra driving past the King Road house three times just before the murders, returning a fourth time at 4:04 a.m. and leaving the neighborhood in a very big hurry 16 minutes later. Nick Gibson is a senior at Washington State University and a freelance reporter.
Law enforcement had an idea of what they were looking for long before the public was aware of it.
That's because a BOLO alert, Be On the Lookout, was distributed to police agencies nearly 2 weeks before the appeal to the public for tips about a white Elantra. A campus cop at Washington State University saw that BOLO and took some initiative.
You know, I don't mean to sound snobby about it, but you're not looking to campus police officers. Usually their jobs are basically writing tickets on campus. But this showed some initiative, and it was incredibly helpful to this case.
On November 29th, after the BOLO went out, this campus cop did a little research, as Nick Gibson told us.
WSU has, like many universities or big entities, they have a parking services department. And so any university employees will have their parking pass with their registration, their license plate, you know, make and model in the system already.
And in that system is where the campus cop found a Hyundai Elantra, white, with Pennsylvania plates. The car was registered to a Brian Kohlberger. First time that name turned up, actually. Kohlberger was a PhD student in criminology and part-time teaching assistant. He lived on campus. The second campus cop went out to take a look.
So that area is on-campus housing. It's popular among graduate and professional students.
And there it was, in the complex parking lot, a white Elantra. But was it the car the police were looking for or not? The car in the lot had Washington State license plates, not Pennsylvania. And the BOLO said 2011-13 Elantra. This was a 2015. But they turned in the tip anyway, and their sighting wound up on a list with lots and lots of other white Elantras. Correspondent Stephanie Gosk has been covering the case for NBC News.
Well, this time, Keith, the task force on this case is getting inundated with information and a lot of information about this car. So they've got all of this information coming in, and it's like a drop in the bucket. They don't know whether or not to pursue this. They don't. They may not have the people to go and look at everyone with a registered white Hyundai Elantra who pops.
So it was on their list, but just not prominently on their list.
It must have been a long list.
And so on that list it sat, waiting for attention. And investigators remained in the dark about that particular 2015 Elantra and its owner, quite unaware of him or his plan to take a long trip clear across the country from Washington State University and far out of reach of those detectives working so hard back in Moscow. Or so he may have hoped. But as he celebrated the season, did he worry what they might discover? Or who might soon be just outside, watching? Monday, December 12th, the start of final exams at Washington State University across the border from Idaho. A pressure cooker of time, of course, but especially now, senior Nick Gibson.
So it's finals weeks, they're grinding, many of them are mourning, many of them are fearing for their safety.
Winter break couldn't come soon enough. Nick was headed home like so many others. Brian Kohlberger, too. His dad had flown out from Pennsylvania to make a cross-country drive home with his son. 2,800 miles in Brian's white Elantra, the very type of car police were looking for.
I would keep an eye out if I'm driving. I'm like, oh, there's a white car. Is that an Elantra?
But as Brian and his dad pulled out of Washington State University, The police did not yet understand the significance of his Elantra, because it was at least 2 years newer than the car they thought they'd seen on security video near the murders. NBC News correspondent Stephanie Gosk.
It was a 2015 Hyundai Elantra. So somebody had it wrong.
The Koberger's cross-country trip started out uneventfully. On December 13th, the Elantra passed under an automatic license reader in Loma, Colorado. 2 days later, December 15th...
Hello.
How you doing?
How y'all doing today? Good, good. Take a look at your driver's license real quick, if I could.
A traffic stop in Indiana for tailgating. Brian at the wheel.
We're slightly punchy because we've been driving for hours.
Hours, days.
Hours to drive. Well, yeah. Almost a day.
Okay.
Minutes later, a second traffic stop, just down the road, still in Indiana. But no citation either time. Was that just a coincidence or something more?
A lot of people thought the FBI was following them all the way across the country. Not the case.
And there was a theory that the FBI asked the Indiana State Police to stop them on the road and get this video of them, which sounded like it made some sense, but our sources tell us it just was not the case.
All pure coincidence.
Pure coincidence.
A day later, Friday the 16th, the Elantra arrived at its final destination, Albrightsville, Pennsylvania, 90 miles north of Philadelphia. The Koberger home is in a gated community. Brian settled in for the holidays. And back in Idaho, the week before Christmas, the investigators finally caught a very big break. DNA from the knife sheath found at the crime scene had been analyzed by forensic genetic genealogists. A law enforcement source told us the genealogist suggested investigators focus on a particular family tree.
Our source tells us they got a list, a small enough list, that they got a name.
A name in the immediate family of Brian Koberger. The cops went into hyperdrive. 2 days before Christmas, they used that DNA information to obtain a search warrant for Brian's cell phone records and found a treasure trove. Like the fact that Koberger's phone was nearly always on, but appeared to be off on November 13th from 2:47 a.m. to 4:48 a.m., a window that includes the time police believe the four University of Idaho students were murdered. And just a few hours later, Koberger's phone pinged near 1122 King Road as if he were revisiting the crime scene. It turned out he was very familiar with the King Road house. His phone pinged near it repeatedly in the weeks and months before the murders.
Not only once, not only twice, but 12 times.
Next, investigators got their hands on copies of security camera video from Washington State University and the city of Pullman, where WSU is located. A white Elantra was seen leaving and re-entering Pullman right around the time of the murders. The Elantra police were hoping to see.
Koberger's Elantra spotted traveling towards Moscow right before the window where the Elantra is seen in the neighborhood of the King Road residence. And that Elantra is then seen again re-entering town around 5:26 a.m.
That white Elantra, police finally realized, was it. The one they'd been searching for. It was a 2015, not an earlier model. The same Elantra discovered by that Washington State University campus security officer weeks earlier. And all came together. The videos of Koberger's movements, the 2015 Elantra, the cell records, together with the DNA, the police finally had a suspect.
If they had not used that forensic genealogy, they might never have identified him.
They'd have the material right there in front of them under a big stack of other stuff about white Elantras, but no
right.
Way.
His name gave them the cell phone number, and it wasn't until they got the cell phone number that they could put the cell phone and the car in the neighborhood at the same time.
As Christmas came and went, FBI agents were watching the Koberger home in Pennsylvania. On December 27th, they pulled trash at the home and flew it across the country to the Idaho State Lab for testing. They got the results the next day.
The DNA that they got, they realized, was from the person who was very, very, very likely to be the father of the person who committed the crime. Now, we know Brian Koberger is with his parents. So the DNA that they pulled, they suspect, is his father, the father of the person who committed the murder.
Things happened fast after that. In the pre-dawn darkness of December 30th, 50 agents from the FBI and the Pennsylvania State Police's Special Emergency Response Team surrounded the Koberger house.
Koberger would have been considered a very high-risk target.
Pam Flick, a former FBI agent with 3 decades of experience in the field.
He has allegedly murdered 4 people using a knife. It's a pretty violent crime.
The agents went in with force. They broke multiple windows and doors to gain access to the house.
It's a dynamic entry, so kicking in windows and doors is an extremely dynamic entry, right? It's something that's not done typically all the time.
Brian Koberger was under arrest, taken into custody without incident. It would be several hours before the world learned the news. And after that, all anybody wanted to know was, who was Brian Koberger? You're about to meet some people who knew. Brian Sheehan, general assignment reporter at NBC 10 in Philadelphia, was on the early shift on December 30th. The news day looked sluggish until a hot tip came in.
I get a phone call from my assignment manager saying, we need you to get to the Poconos. We think they have the suspect in the Idaho murder case. I went, what? The Idaho murder suspect in Pennsylvania.
He raced to the Poconos, a mountainous region 90 miles north of Philadelphia. He worked his phones on the way. His colleagues were at it, too. If they were going to break one of the biggest stories in the country, they had to nail the facts.
It was a lot of back and forth, and we had multiple sources tell us this is the guy.
Live in East Strasburg.
By mid-morning, they had it buttoned up. A suspect was in custody.
Time, but again,
Brian broke the news.
This morning, we were being told that a person of interest taken into custody.
As the day went by, everyone learned more.
What I can tell you is we have an individual in custody who committed these horrible crimes.
When Casey Arntz heard the name Brian Koberger, she was stunned and turned to TikTok.
Went to school with the kid. I was friends with him. I wouldn't make something like this up. I am just an absolute shock right now.
Casey met Brian Koberger years ago when they rode the school bus together in eastern Pennsylvania. He was a year younger than her, an overweight kid, she said, and a member of their little gang.
He was laughing, and he was always fun around our friend group because he felt comfortable with us, which was nice, but I'm hearing from other people that he got bullied for his weight.
Bullied even by some of the girls, said Casey. She thought at one point Brian might have had a crush on her, not that they ever dated.
He would like compliment me and stuff. I remember I dyed my hair red one time, and it was like red. Yeah, it was popped. And he said it looked good and that it was more red than orange.
Casey graduated from high school first, but stayed in touch with Brian. He messaged her when he graduated. At some point, she learned he'd developed a heroin habit, but he told her he went to rehab. They lost touch after that, until in 2017, Casey went to a wedding, saw Brian there, and was stunned. He was thin now. Looked, she said, like he'd gotten his life back together.
It was just one of those, holy crap, like, that's Brian, like, he looks so good.
She gave him a hug, which is when she realized, she said, he was very uncomfortable in that social setting.
I think Brian was kind of weirded out that I did hug him, but he still returned the hug. It was just a really awkward hug.
They caught up. He told her he wanted to study criminology, but she didn't see him engage with others once that night. Said, he was closed off, quiet.
He did not dance. He did not talk to anyone else. He was just kind of there.
Casey wasn't the only one floored by Brian's arrest. A former classmate named Madison was, too. She studied with him at DeSales University, a private Catholic college set in the hills of eastern Pennsylvania.
It definitely took me by shock, especially his mugshot. He looked a lot skinnier than I remembered him being.
Last time she saw him, she thinks, was in 2020. They'd taken a criminology course together in her junior year. That was 2018. What stuck with her was how Brian always had to let everyone in class know he knew his stuff, which, she said, became annoying.
Whenever he raised his hand, he definitely took it upon himself to answer the question, but yet then give every single detail that he possibly could to help further his point. It was always like, oh, Brian's answering this question. This is going to take up the whole entire class.
There was something else, she said, not quite creepy, but odd.
He would stare at us. He definitely had very prominent eyes. So I felt like whenever me and my friends would kind of like look over to the side, depending on where he was sitting near us, like I would always catch him staring at us. He wouldn't ever really try to talk to us.
Small as DeSales was, Madison doesn't remember seeing Brian anywhere else on campus. Not in the library, not hanging in the cafeteria, no walking through campus.
I truly only saw him in class.
On January 3rd, Brian Kohberger appeared in a Pennsylvania court. Jason Labar, Monroe County's chief public defender, represented him.
He was very open and upfront and honest with me.
Labar repeated what Brian told him from the start, that he wanted to waive extradition.
He's eager to get back to Idaho so that he will be exonerated of the charges, implicitly meaning that he's innocent of the charges.
Brian's family was at the hearing too, mom, dad, two sisters. They were shocked, Labar said, but supportive. And then it was over. Brian Kohberger was on a plane heading west to the place where he'd arrived only a few months before. His whole life ahead of him then, and maybe a secret life online. Brian Kohberger, by many accounts, had grown up an awkward teen in Pennsylvania. But by last June, it seemed he'd gotten his life together. Graduating from DeSales University with a master's in criminal justice. Soon after, he headed west to Washington State University to start the PhD program in criminal justice there.
He graded papers and occasionally would speak to the class about stuff.
Hayden Stinchfield is a junior in the criminal justice program at WSU. Brian was one of his teaching assistants. Hayden said he was not the kind of TA to hang around after class.
I think he got out before we did, probably because he had to be somewhere, but also because he had no reason to stick around, like because no one was going to go up and talk to him. You know, he
was not really approachable.
Yeah, he exactly. He wasn't a super approachable guy.
Initially, Hayden was not happy with Brian, and he wasn't alone.
He was the guy who was grading your papers. And he graded them harshly.
Yeah, definitely. He had a tendency to go through your work. He would be like, well, what I would have done here is I would have included all this information and I would have talked about this way. And then he would grade you down for that. And that was always annoying to us because it's like, well, you're not telling us we did it wrong. You're telling us how you would have done it at your PhD level. And then you're taking our points for it.
Hayden said that grading style continued for weeks. And then it changed quite suddenly. And now, he wonders, was the change somehow related to the murders?
At a certain point, he started just giving everyone 100s and super high marks, and he stopped leaving notes. And so that sort of like, by the end of the semester, no one was thinking about the little deductions from earlier because a month and a half straight of just 100s doesn't really, kind of evens it out.
When did that change?
Yeah, exactly, right? Looking back, it lines up pretty well also with, obviously, like November 12th, 13th, like through there.
Which was, of course, the date of the murders. Could have been a coincidence, of course. Hayden is probably not the only one looking back now, wondering if Brian Kohberger's behavior changed after the murders. Dr. John Mathias, podcast host and forensic psychologist, said it wouldn't be surprising for the killer, whoever it is, to be transformed after the murders.
I think this is someone who has had a lot of fantasies of revenge and a lot of violent and aggressive impulses over the years that have been weighing heavily on him, and they've created a lot of anxiety and a lot of distress, and I see this as being kind of a release for him.
Investigators know criminals sometimes revisit the scene of their crime. And we know Brian did drive past the house on King Road hours after the murders. And then there was this. Look at these images of a vigil for the Idaho victims on November 30th. Online sleuths got excited by this man walking by, hands in his pocket. Blue coat guy, they called him. Many online believe this was Brian Kohberger. And he was not. Wasn't him at all. And the viral theory collapsed, soundly debunked. A cautionary tale, given all the rumors flying around. On the other hand, as the investigation continues, police are looking seriously at another possible sighting of Brian. On a Facebook account bearing the name Papa Roger, and this image. Amateur sleuths and police investigators are sifting through old posts, trying to determine if Papa Roger was actually Brian Kohberger. Here's one of Papa Roger's posts. Of the evidence released, the murder weapon has been consistent as a large fixed-blade knife. This leads me to believe they found the sheath. But that was posted November 30th. Law enforcement didn't reveal they found a knife sheath until January 5th. So was it a wild guess? Or something more? Dr. John and Lauren Mathias have been studying Papa Roger's posts.
The number of people that would know or speculate that a sheath was left behind had to be very limited.
You got in an argument about someone with the sheath, defending why someone was like, why would someone be dumb enough to leave a sheath behind? And the guy's like, well, you would just carry a knife around without one? Like, right. He got really defensive.
Somebody was questioning the criminal's intelligence, which you don't do with Brian Kohberger.
And this was a kind of an aggressive response to that question.
Yeah.
In December, Papa Roger peppered the forum with questions, delving into detailed discussions about the timeline the night of the murders. Sounding like a person obsessed or scared. The Mathias say Brian himself could have been feeling that way.
I think he was scared. With that sheath missing, he certainly was worried.
There was a loose end out there. He may not have been aware of the other loose ends with the car movements, et cetera, but he'd certainly know that he left the sheath behind.
Yeah.
Those knives without a sheath are dangerous things to be holding in your hand.
Yeah.
There is this. After the arrest, those online say Papa Roger fell silent. More curiosity surfaced, including this. A research survey written by Kohberger while a grad student at DeSales. He had posted it on Reddit. It was directed to convicted criminals, asking questions to understand how emotions and psychological traits influence the decision-making involved in committing a crime. Questions like, why did you choose that victim or target over others? And after committing the crime, what were you thinking and feeling?
I know he's doing this for other people, and he's trying to find subjects that have committed crimes, and he's interested in their thought processes. But I think he's also giving us a glimpse into his psyche and the way he's thinking about committing a crime.
But for all the theories and speculation, there is something only one person in the world knows right now. The killer's motive. Hayden Stinchfield spoke for just about everybody here.
I'm really curious to find out because it is so far from what, you know, a normal person would do.
On January 5th, the probable cause affidavit was unsealed, revealing, finally, evidence and answers.
Case that is gripping the nation.
The killing of four University of Idaho students.
Many questions unanswered and no arrests.
For 6 weeks, students at the University of Idaho had lived as if there was a night-dwelling medieval monster in their midst, turning the murders of Kaylee and Madison and Zanna and Ethan into something of a fable-like horror story. So when Brian Koberger made his first public appearance in a Moscow, Idaho courtroom last Thursday, millions of eyes were focused on him, trying to see if there was a monster behind that face as the judge read the charges against him.
Count 2 alleges that you committed the felony offense of murder. 3 alleges that you committed count 4 alleges that you committed count 5 alleges that you committed the felony offense of murder in the first degree. The maximum penalty for this offense is death or imprisonment for life. Do you understand?
Yes.
Stephen Christie made a point of driving the 95 miles from their home to sit behind the man investigators think killed their daughter.
What was it like to sit in that room, watch him?
He looks scared, as he should be. If he is indeed the person, I feel that no mercy should be given to him.
Brian Koberger, of course, has only been charged with the four murders. He has not been convicted of anything. But before this hearing started, the state released this 18-page affidavit laying out the case against him. It's a legal document that starts off like a medieval horror story, beginning with an eyewitness account from Dylan Mortensen, one of the roommates who survived, who was not assaulted. Dylan said she woke around 4 a.m. by what sounded like Katie Gonsalves playing with her dog. Then a voice saying, "There's someone here," followed by crying, and a male voice saying, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." Dylan said she opened her door to check on what was happening and saw a man clad in black clothing and a mask walking towards her. She said she stood in a frozen shock phase as the man walked past her and toward a backsliding glass door. We don't know from the affidavit if the man saw her or not, though Dylan did say she locked her door and hid in her room, and for reasons unknown, 8 hours passed before someone called 911. Retired FBI agent and current university professor Greg Rogers teaches a course on psychological profiling and gave us his take on the killer's behavior that night.
If the one roommate statements are accurate about what she heard the male saying to one of her roommates about it's okay, don't worry, it's going to be all right, he was well rehearsed. He'd been thinking about this for a long time. He was acting out a fantasy, and he was well prepared.
What did you see that comment, if it's accurate? What was that intended to do?
His study in his doctoral and master's programs were behavioral aspects, so he's well versed in the psychological aspects of how people think, how they behave. So he's trying to calm her down and obviously doesn't want her to scream and alert her roommates. It shows a very calm demeanor on his part to have this normal conversation with. It's eerie. It's frightening.
Later, while searching Kaylee and Maddie's room, investigators found that K-bar knife sheath on the bed next to the two friends.
He could have easily acquired a handgun if he wanted one. He could have acquired it legally or illegally. He chose a knife on purpose. You pull out a big K-bar like that, it's incredibly frightening. That's why they choose these weapons. It's to just really scare their victims and to get control.
And yet, the knife, or that sheath at least, ended up being the key to the case.
Leaving the sheath in the apartment, that was a huge mistake on his part. Probably fell out of the backpack, or maybe he was pulling the knife out and it slid off. Who knows? But that's as good as it gets.
Steve and Christy Gonzalez take some comfort in thinking, hoping, their daughter Kaylee played some hand in solving her own murder by snatching the sheath from her assailant.
When we read where it was found, I just said, can you believe that? And I said, I hope that maybe in a struggle she pulled it off of him.
Yeah, it's a checkmate type moment.
Yeah.
And our girls were a part of it.
Yep.
Now the man accused of committing these monstrous murders is in custody, waiting, he said, to be exonerated, waiting for vindication. But given all the damning evidence against him, from DNA to cell phone records to surveillance camera footage, what could Koberger's defense possibly be?
Anything you can think of that you would do to defend a guy like this in a situation like this?
The first thing you have to do is get your arms around it. There's so much information, but this is a tough case, no doubt about it.
It was the crime shows that started it, prosecutors will tell you. And now jurors tend to assume every trial will include rock-solid evidence like either cell phone records or DNA. The case laid out in this affidavit has both cell phone and DNA evidence and more surveillance camera footage of the white Elantra.
I think it was one of the better probable cause affidavits I've ever read. Very tight and well written.
We asked James Seeby, former president of the Idaho Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, to take a look at this case and review the affidavit for us.
This is a tough case, no doubt about it.
Is there anything about this particular case that you find unique?
Well, that's a big question. Yes, of course. Stabbings, that's somewhat archaic to me with all the firearms everybody has. It's real macabre, to have the stabbing aspect thrown in. I think that's the thing that sticks out in my mind, and I'm sure bothers a lot of other people.
At the moment, the state's case looks strong to you.
Well, I don't know if I hesitate to say strong, but it looks pretty solid, that's for sure.
If there's a plea deal, all those families would have to agree to a deal, wouldn't they?
Well, not technically agree, but no prosecutor would, in my mind, worth their salt, would not listen to them.
We don't know what Maddie and Zanna and Ethan's families would think about a possible plea offer. But Kaylee's parents told us if Koberger is guilty, they have no interest in striking any kind of bargain with him.
We live in Idaho, and Idaho has the death penalty. We're hopeful for that.
For the death penalty?
That's yes. The consequences of these. If attacking somebody while they're sleeping in their bed isn't probable cause for you to be
unprovoked,
removed from the planet, what does? He chews over and over to end people's lives. And that has to be accounted for.
Yep.
It has to be.
That's not to say the Gonsalveses don't want answers. The biggest question of all, the one that tortures the families, confounds the investigators, is why? If Brian Koberger is the killer, why did he do it? He didn't appear to know anyone living in the King Road house. What is known, according to the affidavit, is that Koberger's phone was detected near the house at least a dozen times prior to the killings, and as long ago as August 21st, 2022.
I think he became obsessed with one of these victims. Could be just as simple as something. She might have served him in one of the restaurants they worked at. He might have just seen her. You never know.
You have seen it before in cases you've covered in your own class.
Yeah. He may not have even ever spoken to any of them. He may have spoken to one of them and done something awkward and asked for a number and been rejected and got upset.
Just a theory, mind you. There's no proof. But the Gonsalveses also suspect Koberger was stalking their daughter Kaylee and her friends.
Our PI and some retired officers told us that to expect that he may have done dry runs where he got close, checked doors, checked windows. We don't know this for a fact, but we do know that he was close enough to the house that his phone, on some of these occasions, that he was communicating with their Wi-Fi, which everybody knows
You have to be very close.
That's the psychology behind it. They dig it. And if this was very satisfying to him, which it likely was, he'd have been back over and over and over.
Now, he's in jail, and the long, deliberate, slow walk toward justice can begin. Students at the University of Idaho are beginning to return to campus, ready for a new semester, no longer afraid of a monster lurking in the night.
I think it's great that, you know, the investigation has gone the way it has and that there's someone there in custody.
It definitely does feel better knowing that there is someone who the police think is responsible that is in custody.
It feels good, honestly. I like to be here. I like to be learning and furthering my education. It feels good to be home.
Kohlberger was back in court Thursday for a status conference, a routine legal proceeding in a case that's anything but.
All right.
The sole item on the agenda was to establish a date for the preliminary hearing. That is when prosecutors will present the evidence they have on Kohlberger. Enough evidence, apparently, that Kohlberger's attorney, who submitted this lengthy request for discovery, said she needed months to go through it all.
We are going to ask the court to set preliminary hearing out into June.
Mr. Kohlberger, have you had enough time to speak with Ms. Taylor about your decision to waive your right to a speedy preliminary hearing?
Yes.
I will go ahead and reserve the week, so June 26th to June 30th, in the event that we need all 5 days for presentation of evidence.
What Kohlberger's defense ultimately will be is still unknown. James Seeby, though, told us Kohlberger's counsel, Ann Taylor, is a tough veteran trial attorney.
Ann's one of the best.
What makes her one of the best?
Well, her range of experience, personality, intelligence. She's a former prosecutor, been involved in a lot of really big trials, had a good success rate, I'd say. So, I have the highest regard for her.
We asked to speak to Taylor, but she, like the other lawyers and investigators involved in the case, is subject to the judge's gag order. So, the quest for justice grinds slow, as ever. As parents learn to go on somehow without their children. Steve and Christy told us they are determined that Kaylee be remembered, not for the terrible way she died, but for the joy she brought to those who loved her.
The incredible amount of love and support that we've got. We have people across the world reaching out. We get letters, handwritten letters that are 5 pages long. I've had bracelets made for me and people making special pictures with Kaylee and sending them to me.
And it might seem kind of bizarre, but it really does help.
I wish they could see how much their lives meant to so many.
You want to be able to go and tell her that?
Yes. I would love to be like, Maddie and Kaylee, look at this. Yeah. Look what your lives meant to everyone.
4 bright young people. Imagine what they could have been.
That's all for this edition of Dateline. We'll continue to bring you the latest on this case here on Dateline, on NBC Nightly News, and on Today. I'm Lester Holt. For all of us at NBC News, good night.